On the last occasion, we tried to create context for this consideration as well as we might. And in the course of that, we have come up with the conclusion that to a major extent, the arrival of Gnosticism, of the both in its Christian form and the Hermetic Gnosis, were the re-embodiment or the continuation within the early Christian era of the impulse that had started long ago in the Mediterranean world in the form of the mysteries. And so this is very important, I think, to keep in mind that for a long time, prior to the coming of the Christian era, prior to the coming of Christian Gnosticism, there existed a form of spirituality in the Mediterranean world which was directed not to belief and behavior after the fashion of the popular folk religiosity of every period and of every geographical location, but rather to something else, namely the essential transformation, the interior self-discovery, and thereby the spiritualization of the individual. So this task was addressed throughout the ancient world by what were called the mysteries. And the mysteries, to recapitulate and also to bring to our attention the method which we find in Gnosticism, the mysteries operated primarily with the strategy of having a central myth, a myth which exemplified within its structure the issue of individual transformation. Let's say, if we pick as in an exemplary fashion, and I will only refer to it very, very briefly, the most effective, the most famous of all mysteries, the Eleusinian mysteries, located in Elefsis in Greece, had as their central myth the myth of Persephone and her mother Demeter, or if you want to turn it around the other way, of Demeter and her daughter Persephone. And here we have, of course, the story of someone who is being taken forcibly, as Persephone was, from the sunny flowering surface of the earth into the dark foreboding regions of the underworld, and then her various struggles and the struggles of her mother in discovering her and in some fashion, at least partially, accomplishing her return to the original condition of beatitude. And undoubtedly, this myth, like all the others, was not just a story about some goddesses, or in other cases gods, long ago and far away, but rather was a symbolic, a metaphorical tale depicting the conditions and the vicissitudes and ultimately the transformative redemption of the individual human soul, as indeed such little information as leaked out from the Eleusinian mysteries tells us. The individual initiate of the mysteries came to identify his or her own fate and story with that of Persephone, and by way of that identification and the various experiences which were afforded these people in the mystery, the exact nature of which we don't know, because they were secret and the people were very, very good at keeping the secret. By way of undergoing these experiences, the people underwent an essential transformation. And there were others, of course, and various nations had their own favorite mysteries, such as, for instance, the mysteries of Isis and Osiris in Egypt, and various others. We also mentioned that among the Hebrews, this pattern did not exactly exist, not in that fashion, because the monotheistic framework did not quite allow for that. Yet we can see that at least a few hundred years, maybe 150, 200 years or so prior to the time of Jesus, something rather analogous certainly existed among the Jews, and that was the phenomenon of the spirituality of the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, often also called the Essenes, who certainly also practiced within the Jewish mythos rites and activities of transformation. Their scriptures, which were discovered within less than a year of the discovery of the great Gnostic Nag Hammadi library, a little bit later, the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls, give eloquent testimony of the exalted transformational and transformed character of the spiritual visions and contacts of these people. So that then, when the Christian religion came to constellate itself around the figure of a sort of, not exactly an Essene, because that's an overstatement, there is no evidence that Jesus was an Essene, but there is, let's say, a considerable likelihood that both he and John the Baptizer, who in some ways apparently acted, if not as Jesus' teacher, then at least his initiator, because that's what the baptism in the River Jordan was, that these people had a contact with, an affinity with the spiritual matrix that existed among the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that therefore they did not... there were not voices crying in the wilderness, even though John is supposed to have called himself that exactly, but rather there was a preparation. There were people who were interested in this sort of thing, people who were committed to a heterodox matrix of mystical thought and practice in the Palestinian region, in what in that time was called Judea, in the Jewish kingdom, and that no doubt these were the first people who were recruited to the new movement, originally perhaps represented by John the Baptizer and then by Jesus. However, as the Christian movement then developed, it soon became apparent that within the early Christian movement there were at least two major parties. There were those who were interested in the sort of thing that we were talking about, who were interested in personal transformation, spiritual regeneration, in the interior redemption of individuals, along the line of the spirit of the mysteries and the spirit of the people of the scrolls. And then there were others who tried to make a much more prosaic, a much more historicized, factually oriented kind of mainstream religion out of early Christianity. the people who pursued the path of the mysteries within the newly arisen Christian matrix were the ones who came to be called Gnostics or Knowers, and they flourished to a considerable degree, although they were never a majority movement, for understandable reasons, but they flourished to a considerable extent for upward of two centuries, and in their further developments, such as the religion of the Prophet Mani in Persia and others, for yet another couple of centuries or so. That is the central focus: religion as individual personal transformation, as the spiritualization of the individual. Not just a new set of rules, not just a new set of teachings, not just a new messiah to hold up as a figure for worship, but rather a new keynote, a new method for the personal transformation of the individual. Now, I threw out some hints, let's say, about the central mythos of the Gnostic teaching toward the conclusion of our discussion last time. At this time, I will propose to pursue it on the basis of what might be called the simplest, the most readily and easily comprehensible statement of the Gnostic myth, in fact sort of the Gnostic monomyth, which however is in this case, let's say, without some of the details and elaborations that we find in other statements. I might say right away that, of course, since the Gnostics followed the mystery method, they had to have a myth, or indeed myths, although they all tell pretty much the same story with a variety of emphases and elaborations. The prosaically minded school of Christian religiosity, on the other hand, discarded the mythic approach. It was not important to it, and it tried to make something factual out of the story. So it reduced myth to fact, alleged fact, let us say. While, of course, a great deal of the New Testament is of a mythic character, but as you very well know, on the basis of what Christianity has become, it was no longer interpreted as such. And if you speak to the conventional mainstream Christian today, he will tell you that, the gospel is fact, the gospels contain facts, and facts are superior to myth, to which the gnostically inclined individual, or in modern times he probably didn't call himself a Gnostic, but I certainly consider him an honorary Gnostic, dear old Joseph Campbell of beloved memory, and others would have said, balderdash, myth is always far more important than fact. Facts come and go, facts are easily forgotten, facts happen every day, but the myth goes on. The myth is eternal, and it is eternal because it is your story. Whether you consciously realize this or not, what takes place in the myth takes place in you, and that this was particularly true of the myths of the Gnostics. Now, the Gnostics several major mythic themes. I will just briefly refer to them and then pick one for our considerations. There is, first of all, the myth of Christ, the life and the story of Christ the Redeemer. that the sort what might be called the soteriological myth. Then another very important myth is the myth of the divine feminine that has fallen into the world and into the chaos, which is known as the myth of Sophia, because Sophia or wisdom is the name given to this person by the Gnostics. That makes two. There is the myth which we will deal with now, which is the universal myth of the journey of the human spirit or the human soul. Where it comes from, how it comes to its present condition, and in what manner and by way of what kind of assistance it may come forth, lift itself out of its present predicament. There are other myths that may be added, and we will just throw in another mythic theme, the fourth, which is the myth of the demiurge. I referred to that in some form before, namely a kind of secondary god or big angel who has to do with the fabricating of the cosmos and the management of the cosmos within which we find ourselves, but who himself is alienated from the original divine source and who then acts as a sort of an obstacle of our of the recovery of our original estate. So there we have four major mythic themes. But in after a fashion, or the other three are pretty well subsumed in the one monomyth, which is the myth of the journey of the soul. This myth of the journey of the soul is most clearly and concisely and at the same time poetically stated in a curious little scripture that has usually been translated under the name of the Hymn of the Pearl, although sometimes also as the Hymn of the Robe of Glory. It is contained within a larger cycle of scriptures called the Acts of Thomas. Now, these are not to be confused with the Gospel according to Thomas, or the Book of Thomas the Contender, or other scriptures that are associated by name or otherwise with the Apostle Thomas. But you must remember that the early Christian movement had a lot of scriptures. It wasn't just the four Gospels and the Old Testament. It was a matter of selection, a sort of a selective censorship that went on for a considerable period of time, wherein the prosaic, the non-mystical party came to decide which of these scriptures were the ones that would be safe for use according to their purposes, according to their lights. And there were a number of scriptures that were eliminated. And some of these were scriptures that were called Acts, just like we have the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament. And there is one quite extensive one of these is called the Acts of Thomas, which tells reportedly the life story of the Apostle Thomas, you know, the Apostle of Jesus, sometimes called Doubting Thomas by some people, including the tradition or the traditional story that he was the only one of the apostles who journeyed as far away from Judea as India and went to India to spread the Christian faith and actually died there. Now this is not a fabrication. There is a good deal of evidence indicating that this actually might have happened. This does not belong in the same category as the rank balderdash that is circulating that Jesus went to India and things like that, you know. When you see books like that, I would say if you don't own them, then definitely don't waste any money on them. If you own them already, then see if somebody else is foolish enough to pay for it and sell it, because you should get rid of them. But as far as Thomas having gone to India, that's far more likely. There is his tomb where he was buried is still being shown in the state of Madras in southern India, and St. Thomas Mountain. When you fly in with the airplane to the city of Madras, you fly over it. You can see it right down below. It's not very far from the coast. But the body of St. Thomas had been taken from that tomb by his church, the Syrian Orthodox Church, and taken back to Syria and interned in Syria, where it possibly still is. Now, in these acts and in connection with Thomas's journeys in India, there is a beautiful little story from which I will quote, which I will mostly summarize to you, and it's put into the dramatic form of Thomas being arrested by his enemies in India and being thrown in prison, where he eventually was martyred. But as he comes into the prison, story, there are all sorts of prisoners, who many of them were locked up there probably for a long period of time, and they all gather around him and they beg him to tell them a story that would instruct them in spiritual things and would divert them from their troubles. And then he tells them the story of the hymn of the pearl, or the hymn of the robe of glory. The story is told in the first person, as if Thomas were speaking himself, but it's not really Thomas, but rather a heavenly being without a name, whom we can readily really recognize the prototype and the archetype for the human soul. And the self-revelation begins by this being speaking of himself in the following manner. When I was a little child and dwelt in the kingdom of my father's house and delighted in the wealth and splendor of those who raised me, my parents sent me forth from the east, our homeland, with provisions for the journey. From the riches of our treasure house they tied me a burden, great it was, yet light, so that I might carry it alone. They took off from me the robe of glory which in their love they had made for me, and my purple mantle that was woven to conform exactly to my figure, and made a covenant with me, and wrote it in my heart that I might not forget it. When thou goest down into Egypt and bringest the one pearl which lies in the middle of the sea, which is encircled by a roaring serpent, thou shalt put on again thy robe of glory and thy mantle over it, and with thy brother, our next in rank, be heir in our kingdom. That is the first division of the hymn of the pearl. So we find ourselves at the beginning, at the top of what might be conceived as a circular path in the kingdom in the east. Here is a being who declares himself to be the child of the Most High, a child of divinity. But he is sent forth from heaven. He has to leave the heaven world and come to a strange country. This country is described, no doubt metaphorically, as Egypt. But it is really a metaphor for the world, for Earth. There are good reasons for that. First of all, Egypt was generally called in the Mediterranean region as the Dark Land. Not because of the darkness being associated with evil and nastiness necessarily, of which I'm sure the Egyptians were as capable as anyone else, but rather because of the darkness of its soil. the black mud which is brought by the river Nile and which inundates the Nile Valley and which is the foundation of the agricultural economy therein. And it is generally believed that the ancient Egyptian name for the land Khem also means the dark land. In addition to that, there is of course the great story in the Old Testament, after which a book of the Old Testament is named, called Exodus. In Exodus, Jewish people are held captive in Egypt. And so Egypt becomes, at least within the Judaic and later on the Judeo-Christian matrix, a symbol for captivity, for being held captive. So this is the dark land where one can fall into captivity. So from a very beautiful, a very free, a very full, a very divine life, one is sent forth into a dark and dangerous place where one can easily be captured. Now the big question is, for what reason, to what end? The Gnostics have often been accused by people who were either ill-informed about their teachings or who wanted to distort their teachings of dwelling on a sort of purposeless fall of the soul, on the notion that we have gone away from God, or we have been thrown out of heaven or something of that sort, without any reason. Well, here, however, the reason is stated. But of course it is stated mythologically, and the mythological statement is that down in the dark land in Egypt there is a pearl which lies in the middle of the sea and is guarded by a monster, by a serpent, a roaring serpent. And this treasure, the teller of the tale, this individual, is to take and to bring it back to heaven. When that is accomplished, then he shall be restored to his original condition, to his original glory. The robe of glory and mantle shall be put back on him. And there is also an indication of a twin or a brother of his own, rather like in the story of the prodigal son, which is not all that unlike this one, only perhaps of a less exalted symbology, and will be restored to his place as the heir in the kingdom. So what this is a description of what has happened to us in the past. How have we gotten to our present condition? We are not from here. We have not grown out, as extreme naturalists or extreme evolutionists would have it, that we sort of developed or grew out of the primeval slime of this earth and are now a kind of glorified and sinking slime. Just a highly developed slime nevertheless. Well, considering how some people act, one might be inclined to think that there could be perhaps a chance of that. But rather we have come from elsewhere. Now this elsewhere, however, is not to be envisioned as a physical locality, but rather it is a spiritual locality. So what you have to always keep in mind here, that physical, psychological, and deeper than psychological, that is spiritual data, are all intermingled in these myths. Because the myths can be interpreted on several levels simultaneously, and all of the interpretations, if one arrives at the right interpretations, are valid. Okay? That's Madame Blavatsky, the interesting old lady who incidentally was very very favorably disposed toward the Gnostics and wrote about them in very laudatory terms at the time when hardly anyone did that sort of thing, for instance, said that every myth can be interpreted in seven different ways, and that all seven would be true. They are only true on different levels of consciousness. Well, I can't claim to have that many, and I will not even go through all the various interpretations, but I just want to indicate that what we are always dealing with in these myths is a principle of a spiritual happening which takes place on different levels. So certainly, if you want to look at the physical side of things, you might say that even at the very physical level, this story is true. We come from our mother's womb, where, for the most part, if things went well, we, as an unborn child, enjoyed a sort of semblance of a celestial protected beatitude. And from there we are thrown out into the physical world, where in due course of time we can easily be captured by various external forces. We are born, presumably, with some secret purpose, not just the purpose of adding on other walking, talking lump of flesh to the many lumps of flesh who are walking and talking and overpopulating this earth already, but that there is some kind of an essential deeper purpose to our birth. And that when that purpose is accomplished, then we might return to a state of consciousness again, where physicality, our presence in the physical world, are no longer necessary and no longer called for. At the psychological level, we might say we do the same thing. So now I'm not telling you anything new, because these things are present in psychological literature of the last number of decades. You know, Jung always said that the physical birth is a symbol of the psychological birth. So at the psychological level, let us say, we also come forth from a kind of an undifferentiated psychic wholeness. That is our spiritual mother. We come forth and we are born into the ego world, and as the old spiritual says, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. In the course of our lives, we all experience that forlornness, that isolation, that sadness, because we have lost something. Now the very materialistic kind of people who always pop up again and again, and who have this great obsession with the birth trauma, you say, oh yeah, that's because we were born out of our mother's womb. The psychologists, on the other hand, of a more profound vision, such as people like Junger, say, it's not the physical birth that is really the issue, but the psychological birth. And this psychological birth has as its ultimate objective the finding of a treasure. And that treasure is the treasure of consciousness, of being conscious. So then in the psychological sense, possibly the pearl might be envisioned as the consciousness that we find when we go forth into the world. But certainly these two are not the only levels of interpretation that exist, and there are yet others. And so there must be then a spiritual treasure, something that might be the spiritual essence of consciousness. Perhaps the discovery of something here that Obviously, the myth tells us that the pearl is there already in Egypt when we arrive. It's not something that we manufacture. It's not something that comes as the result of our activities. We find it, and then we take it back. This, of course, connects with the Gnostic mythic theme that exists in many of the other myths, that we are not the first spirits of God arriving in this world of manifestation. Others have come before us and have gotten lost. In fact, there are often series of someone goes forth, and we'll see that in the minute how it happens to us. Someone goes out for a purpose and gets lost. Someone else is sent to find the lost one and gets lost himself. And so there are series of these emanations, each one trying to find the other until eventually an awakening takes place. And at least a certain number of these are taken back. So that is the beginning of our story, and I will summarize what happens now. So he leaves his original home, the East, and is on his way downwards. At first he is accompanied by envoys, by spirits from heaven. He is in company, and he is wearing his garments, his heavenly robe. And then he comes to a boundary, to what in some of the Gnostic scriptures is called the Horos, which is really the limit. This is the limit of the transcendental, the higher worlds, that divides the higher worlds from the lower. At that boundary, they stop. And the envoys, the helpers, the angels can no longer go with him. So he takes off his beautiful robe and he hands it to them. And now for all intents and purposes he's naked. He does not have this anymore. And now alone, unaccompanied, without his robe, he descends yet further down into the lower worlds. As he comes down into the land of Egypt, the first thing that happens to him is that he comes to a way station, an inn, as travelers are wont to do. You know, when you are out on the road, especially on an inhospitable rainy night, like we are probably having right now, those flashing signs of a motel on the roadside are a great comfort. So travelers have always stopped at the inns. So he stops at an inn, which is, however, within sight, reasonably close to the ocean, in which there is the pearl and the serpent guiding the pearl. So he has come close to his objective, and now he stops. He comes to the inn. And there are various people. Among them there is one who says who is different from the local dwellers, from the Egyptian, but who is more like someone of his own kind. And this companion warns him, says, be careful. If you eat and drink what they offer you here, the likelihood is that as the result of ingesting this food and drink, you will fall into a state of forgetfulness. You are going to forget where you came from. You are going to forget why you came here. You are going to forget who you are. And your whole mission will have aborted. So he tries to take this to heart, but it doesn't quite work out. Undoubtedly, he gets too hungry and too thirsty to be able to follow this advice for too long. He eats of the food and drinks of the drink of the Egyptians, and what has been predicted happened. He falls into a deep state of forgetfulness. Amnesia, the forgetfulness, that the Gnostic speaks of. Now I would say we have arrived down there toward the bottom of the circle. At the lowest point, we have arrived at what place? The place where we are right now. This is the existential condition of the human being. Like a traveler from a far place, we have come to what we thought was an inn. Of necessity, we have come to avail ourselves of the nourishment of various kinds of the place where we are. And as the result of this involvement in our locale, we have become forgetful of everything that is important. So we find ourselves in a pitiful state. This is, of course, the recognition that a relatively small number of philosophers and some people within the field of religion over the last 2,000 years from time to time come to recognize and pinpoint as the alienation, the forlornness of the soul. We find references to it in religion because the religious life sooner or later stimulates insights in people that, are of a Gnostic nature. Tertullian, an early Christian teacher who was, however, not a Gnostic, coined the phrase which in Latin is called anima naturaliter Christiana, means the soul which is by its nature Christian. And I like to turn that around and say anima naturaliter gnostica, meaning that our soul, our spirit of its own, without any external information, or as nowadays in computerese they like to call it input, you know, in any event, without any, external stimuli, under certain circumstances, the human soul, the human psyche, arrives at insights which are essentially of a Gnostic nature. Because none of these kinds of spirituality are purely or even primarily a matter of transmission. It's not just a matter that you learn something that somebody teaches you and he learned it from somebody else who taught him and so back to I don't know where, to some earlier period. But that of course happens too, to some degree. But what happens is that when your soul opens up to a certain level of awareness, it arrives at certain kinds of insight. These insights are here for everyone. But the issue is, are we able to work our way through them? It's a matter of our readiness. It's a matter of our acceptance, very often, our ability to overcome the resistances that exist in our minds to these insights that keep the insights from us. It's not a matter of anyone or any group of people sitting there like great big spiritual dogs in mangers saying, he is not ready for it yet, we are not going to give it to him. Because knowledge is power and all this sort of thing that you find in advertisements in popular magazines, you know. But rather that it is an interior process, which of course may have certain external stimuli. So we have throughout religion and in some philosophical insights the recurrence of that theme. Plato, the philosopher par excellence of the ancient world, or perhaps of any world, spoke of a celestial world where the archetypes of all things exist. And we, on the other hand, live here. This is his famous analogy of the cave, which I think comes from the Phaedrus. We live in a world of shadows. We see the shadows that are the reflections of true things, but we don't see the true things themselves. So this is a world of shadows. And on the basis of these shadows, we try to form certain conclusions about what reality might really be like. and so on and so forth, right down to contemporary times, to the existentialist people like Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Sartre and Camus and various people like that, who were true Gnostics, at least up to the point that they all placed a very great emphasis on this feeling of forlornness and the condition of forgetfulness, this abject condition of existential alienation and anguish within which the human soul, the human psyche finds itself. Now, the existentialists were never terribly popular in America, and they weren't all that popular elsewhere either, but a little bit more so than here. And why is that? Because their emphases, even as the Gnostic emphases, sort of are in a conflictual relationship with the sort of traditional Pollyanna optimism of the American psyche. And we don't want to admit to ourselves that we are lost. Who? We lost? Well, if I just keep riding on this bronco long enough out here on the prairie, well, I'll find my way somewhere, you know, even if it's into the arrow of some Native American, don't say anything else, or whatever the case may be, you know. But the fact of the matter is, as you will see here, that this anguish and this feeling to the Gnostic, to the existentialist, to this line of thinking, is of extreme importance. Why? Because it is the call that goes back to the source. Hey, mommy, daddy, your son, your daughter, whom you sent down here to find something, is lost, and he doesn't know what's going on, and he doesn't know what he was supposed to find, and it's all going very, very wrong, you know, so you better help me. If you keep on whistling in the dark and pretending that nothing is wrong, then you don't get any help. That's where it's at, to put it in very colloquial terms. So he is now in great anguish because he knows that he's not an Egyptian. Although he puts on the clothing of the Egyptians, he eats their food, and he said he serves their king. In other words, he becomes a tax-paying citizen of this alien land where he lives. But inside of him or her, because there is no gender really mentioned here, that's with sort of the monomyth that fits everybody, man, woman, child, you know, he knows that something is wrong. And so the anguish, the alienation, the anguish of his soul reaches out to his father and mother for help. It comes up, and they recognize that something has gone wrong. And so I'll read you that little portion here. I'm just sort of giving little excerpts. All this that befell me, my parents marked, and they were grieved for me. It was proclaimed in our kingdom that all should come to our gates. And the kings and the great ones of Parthia and all the nobles of the east wove a plan that I must not be left in Egypt. And they wrote a letter to me, and each of the great ones signed it with his name. And here is the text of the letter. From thy father, the king of kings, and from thy mother, the empress of the east, and from thy brother, our next in rank, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's son. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl, for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory. Recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on, and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. Now comes in what in technical sort of philosophical and theological terms is called the soteriological element. Soter in Greek means savior, redeemer. And it is generally believed by students of religious studies, of comparative religion, as we used to call it, that every religion has to have a soteriological element, otherwise it's not really a religion. That doesn't mean it has to have a personal savior after the fashion of Jesus Christ, but there is some kind of a principle, some kind of a happening, which is directed toward the rescuing, the redeeming, the bringing back unto itself and thereby unto the divine, unto God of the human soul. And so this is, let's say, the supremely hopeful element in the Gnostic system. Yes, you are in trouble. Yes, you are in a place where you don't belong, really, even though you came here for a purpose. Although there are disputes, let's say, about what that purpose exactly might be in the different myths, there are different statements. And yes, you have become forgetful of your own estate. You are in amnesia, you don't know who you are anymore. You have even become subservient to an alien king, and so forth. But you are not left alone. Help is available to you. But in order for that help to come to you, you have to call out for it. And you call out for it by the full realization of your plight. When you realize your plight, the redemption is near. The light dawns when it becomes the darkest. Things have to really become dark. Here again, you know, we could go through the physical, the psychological, the spiritual, and heaven knows how many other interpretations. But let's say there is adequate evidence, I think, from some medical circles and so forth, that when there is a fairly complete realization and acceptance on the part of a sick person of his or her condition, then some kind of an improvement, now not necessarily a physical healing, don't misunderstand me, but a spiritual help, an inward healing, a psychological coming to terms takes place. When one does not deny what is happening, then what is happening will bring to us its full impact and message. And when the full impact and message of what is happening has come to us, then often there is no longer any reason for the happening to be happening. Again, don't make this a universal rule. But things happen to us in our lives for a purpose. And if we evade the dark side of the happenings by pretending that it's not there, by giving it a different kind of interpretation, by denying it, by squirming around in various ways, then the message can never really come through to us. When the message has come through to us, then usually there is no longer any need for that particular event to happen. We are now talking in psychological terms. But this is also true in spiritual terms, which is what we are dealing with here. And so now comes as the result of the letter, which came as the result of the anguished inward call for help on the part of the person whom we are dealing with, now comes about the great turn. This is what in Greek is called the metanoia, turning about, turning around, which occurs at the bottom of the circle. He wakes up because the letter has come to him, and the letter is a mystical, magical thing. It flies on the wings of an eagle and it speaks. So, you know, the letter is like a person, indicating that under some circumstances the soteriological element comes to us as a person, a Jesus, a Krishna, a Buddha, a Savior, a Messiah, a messenger of light. Under other circumstances, it might come in a less personalized, in a less embodied fashion. Although I dare say that even though we all may have been turned off considerably by the personalized messiahs and things of that sort, and I dare say their advocates, especially on the religious channel with their wonderfully fitting toupees and their extremely colorful neckties and their very expensive suits, you know, are constantly haranguing us about Jesus, you know. As always, somewhat pronouncing that name as if it were the plural of a certain dairy product, Jesus, you know. But this sort of thing is, of course, very off-putting and disgusting. but we need to keep in mind that there are advantages to the personalized soteriological factor, the personalized help. We are persons, and we do respond to other persons more easily and readily than to just ideas or psychological impulses. When we dream, for instance, our dreams inevitably express themselves in images. Now, they may not always be human images, there can be all kinds of, but they are images. They are not abstract ideas. The psyche does not speak to us in abstract ideas. The psyche is not an academic philosopher having a chair at UCLA and talking deconstructionist babble, you know, or something like that. But the psyche speaks to us in the kind of images that have a real impact on us. And so the letter here is of that sort. So he wakes up. He immediately knows who he is. He knows what he's supposed to be doing. He goes about it. No further problem. The problem was all on the first half of the descending arc of the circle. That is where the darkness, that is where the forgetfulness, that is where the pain, that is where the anguish and the forlornness and all of these things exist. But now he knows. This is very important in a Gnostic point of view, because that knowing is the gnosis. What comes to the individual in the metanoia, in the turning about, the change, is a knowing. And so there is your answer as to what often, to the question that is often asked, well, what is this gnosis? What do these people know? Once I was on a television program here, and a very nice lady was interviewing me, and she asked, well, all right, well, you know, you guys are supposed to be the knowers, so what do the knowers know? And, you know, in certain ways, that's not so terribly easy to answer. But here is the answer. You know who you are. You know where you came from. You know where you are going. And you know what you are supposed to do. That's it. Those are sort of the major steps. And he knows all of that right away. He doesn't just know one little thing. He knows it. Now it's accomplished. So when the gnosis comes, it's sufficient for the purpose. It's not a slow kind of divine trickle-down effect. You know, it's there. It works. Now, speaking for myself, speaking for some people whom I have known within this process and things like that, that doesn't mean that the kind of gnosis that you have, I don't know, at the age 21, is going to be the exactly the same if you continue with this that you will have when you're 60. There will be an amplification, an expansion. I would rather have regretted to have died in my 20s or something like that, for now in retrospect, for only for this one reason, that the things that I knew then already, I know now so much better. They have sunk in. They have been amplified, they have expanded. But in essence, in essential nature, they have not changed, you see, because gnosis is gnosis. No, you either know or you don't know. It's like being a little bit pregnant, you know. No, won't work, you know. You can't just be a little bit knowing. And so that's why the drama now changes. It's no longer so dramatic, so dark, so agonizing. The real agony, the real struggle, the contest element of the drama, you know, is now no longer there. He gets up, he walks out of the inn, he walks over to the ocean, and there is of course the serpent, the dragon, guarding the pearl. Now in the other kind of myths, especially those the medieval heroic myth and things like that, now would be a great big struggle, you know, he would pull out some kind of an Excalibur and start slashing at that dragon and serpent, and who in turn would breathe fire on him, and heaven knows what else might happen yet. But no, nothing like that. It's not that dramatic. He just goes up, and now he does something very strange. He says, he begins to sing. And he sings the name of his father in heaven and his mother in heaven to the dragon. Now, you know what this is? There is a word called enchant. You ever thought of that? To enchant something means, or somebody, means to bring about a magical result by chanting, by singing. You know? So what he does is really he engages in an act of magic. And the magic is accomplished by way of the names of the high gods who are his parents. But you see, he knows those names now, again. He had forgotten them before. So this also, his ability to do this to the dragon is a part of his gnosis, otherwise it wouldn't happen. And promptly the old dragon snake falls asleep. He just reaches in, picks up the pearl, and goes with it. That's it. it's not a matter of fighting the enemy, in a sense, the one who resists your, or is expected to resist your efforts to finding the treasure by his own methods. To bring out the sword and kill the dragon is a dragon-like behavior, you know. But it's a superior form of behavior enters. And with that superior form, the gnosis which he has experienced, the recovery of his knowledge of who he is and whose child he is, brings to him the means whereby this resistance can be stilled. The resisting agency is put out of commission, and he can take the pearl and go with it, to take it back and to accomplish his purpose. And now he rather rapidly ascends up through the regions and comes to the border, and at the border there is the delegation awaiting him. Incidentally, this delegation and the great ones and the nobles of the divine household and his brother and all of this sort of thing that appears again and again in itself is everything here is significant, but we can't, of course, explain them all. But all of this has a considerable significance because it indicates a fullness consisting of a wealth of a variety of powers and expressions of consciousness and being that exist in the higher realms. Jung, I think, has come fairly close to it at a psychological level in his writing about and his description of archetypes. So in the Gnostic picture, it's never this sort of oversimplified, impoverished kind of religiosity where it's just God and me, but usually in the opposite order, me and God, you know, it's just no one else. But there is always a richness of the household, and of course there is also a wealth of powers down below. You can't reduce the multiplicity, the wealth of the expression of consciousness to just one or two images. When you do that, you are dealing with a highly impoverished situation. So there they are, the envoys, the members of the divine household awaiting him, and they greet him, and they place upon him his mantle, which incidentally is a very mystical, a very magical object, because now when he sees them bringing his mantle, he sees it shimmering and shining with a million jewels and in all colors of the rainbow, and he says, I beheld upon it the light of the gnosis of God. So it's a mystical object that contains a great deal of his own knowledge, and then they place it on him, and it's always the embassy. It fits him perfectly. It is made to his form. So it's really rather like the skin of a serpent, or like another body. And you will find references to that in various forms of literature. The light body, the divine body, which he had to leave there because that cannot come down into the world, but now he resumes it. And with the pearl he goes up and further into the realm, and he arrives at the throne of his father and mother and presents them with the pearl. And they thank him for it, and they reward him. And then the very last thing is they after they have done that, they send him yet higher, to present himself to the ultimate being, to the ultimate ruler of all, which is sort of the one without a second, while his parents are the two. Those who are a little familiar with Kabbalistic lore would say Keter is the one to whom he goes ultimately, but his parents, the supernal father and the supernal mother, like Chokmah and Bina, are the ones to whom he brought the pearl. And I don't know again how many Kabbalists there are here, but I could even give you a little suggestion in Kabbalistic terms as to where the pearl ends up on the tree of life. The pearl might end up in the tree of life as Daat, right below the father and the mother, astride the abyss. And the meaning of Daat, when you translate it from Hebrew into Greek, is Gnosis. So he had brought Gnosis to heaven. That is what was needed there. Something that had to be accomplished, that had to be found here on earth. The little story in the Acts of Thomas, which, let's say, details of which are elaborated in all the other myths, is the quintessential statement of what happens. Now, it may not be stated quite in the same way, but we find references to it. For instance, the many references which we find in Gnostic scriptures don't make any sense, unless it is they are understood within a certain context. And this myth and its content present such a context. For instance, in the Gospel of Philip, at the very end of the Gospel, there is a great statement being made that the work of Gnosis has to be accomplished here, in this world. It will not happen in the other aeon. There is something that is to be done here. And when that is accomplished, then we can go back to our original home. Which sort of cuts across all these stupid speculations that people always bring up, or not always, I mean frequently, in connection with Gnostics. Even when that idiotic business was going on down there in Guyana some years ago in the Jonestown massacre, you know. Some people got on the bandwagon and said, ah, well, that's the sort of thing that Gnostics do because they don't like life in this world and so they kill themselves. But let's say there is a misunderstanding sometimes on the part of the people who do it themselves and sometimes on the part of people who are looking at these things, sort of religiously motivated suicides, that the attitude of forlornness and aloneness and alienation and sadness which the messenger, the child of heavens experiences in the world ought to lead to checking out of the world by some sort of suicide. But the issue is that that doesn't accomplish anything. The pearl has to be found, and then everything will be all right. But if you cut your throat or drink the Kool-Aid or whatever you may do before you found the pearl, well, then you are still in. You still haven't done anything. The purpose has not been accomplished, and so let's say that this business of artificially doing away with the body has never been the part of the Gnostic framework. But modern people, when looking at some of these concepts, sometimes turn it in that direction. Look, there's no need hastening that process unduly. You're going to die anyhow. I mean, there hasn't been anyone yet that one knows of in history who didn't. Even Jesus Christ died on the cross. So the thing is, the body will fall apart eventually owing to certain principle of built-in obsolescence, which is right there, just like a car. It doesn't last all that long. Then you will be free of it. And meanwhile, you know, who knows? Like I said to people more than once who came to me and said that they wanted to kill themselves. You know, my answer was always, no, I wouldn't do that because there might just be still something rather interesting happening. Something interesting might come your way. So why cut yourself off from that? You see, this is it. Despair and boredom are twin brothers. They are that close together. You know? And it's really, I think, they both have a certain justification. It's this world is a boring place. There's no doubt about it. It's unbelievably boring. But now and then something interesting happens, you know, and that makes it kind of worthwhile. And if you decide on your own that things are just so boring that they are never not getting anywhere, there might something be just around the corner that will be really interesting and exciting and that will have made quite a bit of boredom worthwhile. Now, these are not things that you hear very often. Because all the New Agers and all the nice people who write and speak in various places, including this place, they all keep telling you how wonderful life is and all of that. But you know what? They don't know what they're talking about. And moreover, you know somewhere deeply inside of yourself that things aren't really that way. You go there and you listen to it and you're kind of a little bit reassured on the surface. But underneath it all, you feel that anguish and that alienation and that forgetfulness of the person whose story is told in the hymn of the pearl. And when you feel that, when you allow yourself to really feel that, and you call out and you say, I know I'm here for a purpose. I know I'm supposed to accomplish something. I know that this is not all, that just this world with its newspapers and its television sets and its jobs and its excitements and its political campaigns, this is not it. There is something else. Show it to me. Allow me to wake up. Send me the letter. When you truly are able to say that with the full impact of the totality of your being, with your body, with your psyche, with your spirit, then it will come, and it will wake you up. And then after that, all will be well. The dragons of this world will be put asleep by your gnosis, by who you are and by what you know. And you will return as a hero of consciousness, in your name written in the great and fiery book of the place above all places, as a hero who has made it, as someone who has returned successfully, and who therefore deserves to be presented to the highest, to the greatest expression of being. This story tells it all. Everything else is a detail. Some of the details are very beautiful and very exciting and very glorious, and others are very cryptic and sometimes very confusing. If you keep this story in mind, this is the story of the Gnosis. This is the story of the Gnostic. This is the story of one who came forth long ago from a far place and who has fought for his consciousness and has discovered the treasure and took it back to the place where both he and the treasure belong. So I thank you very much and bid you good night.